Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is engineer, producer, and composer Bobby Summerfield. But first of all, something interesting that just happened this week that leaked out. It wasn't an announcement, it was a leak that Apple had proposed a new royalty rate for songwriters. Now, before streaming, songwriters got paid what they called a mechanical royalty. So every time there was a CD sale or a vinyl sale, they would make 9.1 cent per song. When we got to digital downloads, that same mechanical royalty rate applied. So for every digital download, the songwriter received 9.1 cent. And this is the songwriter and the publisher who would split that royalty. If the songwriter was the publisher, then the songwriter managed to get the whole thing. When it comes to streaming, however, this rate is a lot less. Generally speaking, for 100 streams, it's somewhere around 5 cents. Maybe a little more, maybe a little less. But generally speaking, you're looking at somewhere around 5 cents per 100 streams. What Apple has proposed is a 9.1 cent royalty rate, just like the standard mechanical royalty rate for sales. Now, this is a very interesting strategic move on Apple's part. First of all, Apple has probably the deepest pockets, besides Google and Amazon, out of any streaming player. So it can afford to almost double the mechanical royalty rate that they're paying out the songwriters. What this does, though, is it puts a lot of pressure on Spotify, because Spotify's already paying out much more than 80% of what it takes in royalty costs. So to have to double that rate now means that it's even more and more difficult for Spotify to make money. And right now, they're not making any money, and they've never made any money, and this makes it even more difficult. Not only that, it also looks a whole lot better in the eyes of the artists. Now, don't forget, the artists have been pretty down on streaming, and they've been down especially on Apple Music from time to time, but of course, this puts them in a much better light. The other thing it does is it makes it easier for Apple Music to get exclusives because of this, and exclusives are what's driving the streaming business right now. So if you can pay a little bit more money, which you can definitely afford, and have the artists on your side, and put your major competitor in a bad way, I'd say that's pretty much a win. So look for this to happen. This is going to be proposed to the Copyright Royalty Board just about any time now. Now, of course, the Copyright Royalty Board may choose not to use this rate, and there may be so much opposition from other streaming competitors that this may go by the wayside, but nonetheless, it's a brilliant strategy. So keep a lookout for it, because this may be a nail in the coffin of many indie streaming networks, especially Spotify. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my 101 Mixing Tricks program and other online video courses on bobbyosinskicourses.com, as well as my music industry and music production blogs. Just go to bobbyosinski.com to find the links, and you can also read some excerpts from my books when you're there. Now, on the production side, something that's kind of interesting that I think most people kind of overlooked is that there's a new breed of flash drive that has come out. Some people call it a flash drive, other people call it a thumb drive, some call it a USB stick, pretty much the same thing. But one thing that's pretty much common is they're all slow. And especially if you get an old USB 2.0 stick, boy, you could be waiting forever when you load up a project on one of those. USB 3.0 is somewhat faster, but not as fast as it could be. One of the reasons why is the tech can't get small enough to go into a thumb drive. You need really, really fast chips, and yes, you can get those, but generally speaking, when you go to solid-state drives, SSDs, the solid-state drives that you have in your computer, for instance, those use a lot of chips in parallel using a controller. This takes a lot of room. But somehow Otherworld Computing has figured out how to do this. Otherworld Computing, if you're not hip to them, check them out, especially if you're a Mac user, because they have great Mac accessories, including all sorts of hard drives, just about anything you can think of for the Mac, and at really good prices as well. I've been using them for 10 years, maybe more. And I've always been really happy with everything I've received from them. So now they've come up with this new flash drive, and they're calling it the Envoy Pro Mini. Now, what's interesting about it, it's 240 gigs. 240 gigs USB 3.0, and it's only $169. But even better, it's 16 times faster than a normal flash drive. And that means it's almost fast enough that you can do your production work on it. Now, just think about it. You don't have to carry a drive around with you anymore. You can do it on this thumb drive, on the flash drive. 240 gigs. Now, there are others available on the market that go as high as 480 gigs, but they're kind of like one-off companies, and they're not all that reliable. And of course, when it comes to storage, you really want a company that makes something that's super reliable, because you just don't want to chance your data being lost. So give this a look. Otherworld Computing, and a fast way to get there is MacSales.com. MacSales.com. It's called Envoy Pro Mini. It's 240 gigs on a USB 3.0 flash drive. My guest today is Bobby Summerfield, who's worked with a variety of great artists, ranging from Michael Jackson to Carole King to world music superstar Johnny Clegg to the legendary Harry Belafonte. He's also a composer with his own music library, and his credits include Oprah Winfrey, The View, Survivor, and ABC's 2020 News, and commercials for Coca-Cola, Ford Motor Company, and American Airlines. Along the way, Bobby's also been nominated for a Daytime Emmy Award. I spoke with him recently at his studio in Los Angeles. You were born in the UK, and then you went to South Africa, right?
Yeah, a bit of a gypsy. Born in the UK, and my mum and dad, I was about 2.5 years old, immigrated to South Africa because of work opportunities. My dad was an engineer, not a recording engineer, but a mechanical engineer, and so he got transferred to South Africa, and lots of Europeans were enticed by South Africa at that stage to come over there because of the, you know. So they went over there, and when they went over there, being typically English, they didn't exactly like it at first, and they didn't exactly assimilate too well because it was quite an Afrikaans sort of, so English people weren't exactly popular. So for the first couple of years, they said, I don't think we like this, and they went back to England. And that happened a total of 7 times. So between England and South Africa, I was 7 times ripped out of schools and everything, but up until the age of 14. And then at 14, we kind of settled and stopped moving around in Cape Town, South Africa. And then I finished my school in there and, you know, basically lived and stayed there. So it was it taught me survival and assimilation in a big way, because you're in one country one moment, one country the next. And generally, you know, what kids are like, they're like, oh, what are you doing, you foreigner? Or what are you doing, you English guy in South Africa, you know? So it taught me a lot of survival.
When you were moving, did you prefer to be in one place or the other?
And that's a really good question. Every time I moved, the grass was always green. That's a human trait. And when I was in one country, I was like, oh, I can't wait to go to the other country. Get to the other country, I'm like, oh, I really miss England. Oh, you know, or vice versa. Yeah. And then when, you know, like South Africa everywhere has better weather than England. But either way, when I'd be in South Africa, it'd be really hot and nice. And we would sort of like that for a little bit. Then after a little while, they'd be like, oh, it's so hot here, we can't stand it. Right. Then we go back to England, oh, it's always raining, it's cold.
Yeah, right. Way different there.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, so you started then as a DJ, right?
Yes. Basically my first... I took piano as a kid at school, when I played drums as a joke. It's, you know, like kids do. Yeah. But I did electronics as a hobbyist from about 14 when I was in Cape Town. My dad sort of encouraged me, you know, you better get something interesting. And I loved doing building things. Actually, even in England, I started doing like crystal radios, you know, that junk.
Yeah, yeah.
And somebody asked me to build them a 50 watt power amplifier when I was 14, because they didn't have enough money to buy a real one. So I did. I got a kit and I built it. And then I gave it to him. I said, here it is. I can't remember. It was like 70 rand is the currency then. It's 70 rand. He's like, oh, I just can't afford it. And eventually I realized I'd done all this work and I couldn't afford it. So I thought, well, what can I do? Maybe I should build a disco system. And then, because that's a big, powerful amplifier, I built another two of them and then put a whole disco system and put it together and sell it. So I started doing that, and I did that, built the four amplifiers, and, you know, it's like 400 watts and 400 watts. So had a good little system going, got a couple of cheap turntables, built a couple of light processes and put it, I've still got the thing, I've still got it here actually, put it all in a box and thought, I'm going to sell this, I'm going to, you know, sell it for, you know, 1,000 rand maybe and make a killing as a, you know, as a 14-year-old. And I sold my bicycle and all my little kiddly possessions to do it. But then somebody said to me, hey, you're in that disco system, can't you come round? It was a girl as well. And I, you know, always
yeah,
a girl in it.
Yeah, exactly. Course, yeah.
And she said, do you want to come round and just play my birthday party for my friends? So I said, yeah, sure, I'll come round. And I had about 50 records at the most. And I went round and I started playing it. And all of a sudden, one of the mothers came up to me and said, would you mind playing my daughter's birthday next week? And I was like, all right. So I ended up making little bits of money. The next minute, a year and a half later, I was playing in really big clubs and kind of quit school to do it. At 16 and a half, strangely enough, I was making more money than my dad's salary was.
Wow.
It's crazy. Yeah. And my dad was pleased but unhappy.
Well, you know, it's funny because we have a very similar background in that I started early in electronics too.
It's a fantastic grounding, right?
Building amplifiers and building equalizers, yeah, and all sorts of things that I couldn't afford to buy. And then I wanted to know where the electrons went, you know, from the guitar into the amplifier. I wouldn't know all about that. So it was the same thing.
Self-taught. I did eventually went to college to learn. I did 2 years at a Technicon, which is called like a Siemens company, to get the proper, so I could do calculations and work it out. But it really, at that stage, I kind of had the gist of it already. Yeah. And it was just a bit of a electronic hack. That's really what I was.
Yeah.
And still am, really, to a degree, you know.
How did you get then from being a DJ to being a recording engineer?
Okay, at 16 and a half, I was sort of DJing around, and I got offered a really good club gig, which was a small club in this very big hotel where all the big bands played. And I was doing this gig, a big band was playing there called Ballyhoo. They were like the biggest band in the land. Really, they were. They were really, really like big band. I had seen them and known them and knew what they looked like as being a pop fan myself. At this stage, finishing off, I worked at an electronic store when I was, you know, selling these parts. While I was finishing off my commitment to that, while I was still DJing, and then I carried on DJing, and this band came in and they were looking for a little op amp for one of their for one of their keyboards. And I spoke to one of the guys, the keyboard player, and I said, "What is it for?" He said, "It's my Mellotron. It's distorting." And somebody said, "This is what's broken. Do you know what it is?" I said, "Oh, yes, a 741. I think I've got one of those." So he said, "Oh, great. Do you know much about music?" And I said, "Yeah, I love electronics and I'm a DJ." And I said, "I actually play at the iBar, which is next door to their club." And he said, "Really? You play there?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Oh, you must come in and see us one night." And I said, "Yeah, I will do, definitely." And so that was it. So I started that little relationship there. And I offered to help them fix their Mellotron if ever they needed, got stuck. Mm-hmm. And so they called me to fix their Mellotron. And which I did, I got it going, you know, and I saw their setup and everything. That was the only introduction I had. And I said, "Well, you know, I'm a DJ, you know, around the corner. So if ever you need, you know, like a DJ, just being a cocky kid, if ever you need a DJ," and they had a big 2,500 seater club for me, it was massive. "If ever you need a DJ, let me know." And they said, "Yeah, okay, sure. So it happens, 6 weeks later, the DJ had troubles with his wife or girlfriend or something and had to leave town and miss a couple of gigs. And they called me up and they said, "Listen, do you want to come and do the stand-in for me?" And I've got goosebumps now. And I was nervous as hell. I said, "Yeah, sure." Shivering in my boots. And that was how I started. But in the DJ booth, to answer your question, in the DJ booth there was this live mixer and a live light switch panel. And they said, "Look, when you finish DJing, instead of just going and sitting and having a drink, we'll pay an extra $50 to sit here and switch the lights on and off. And on this song, turn that yellow knob up."
Yeah.
"And that will send the echo on that voice. And on this song, pull that one down." I said, "Okay, got it." And, you know, I was like that. And then I start tweaking around and going, "Oh, I know how this works."
Yeah.
And then the next minute, I was putting echo on things and they're going, "Oh," and every now and again, I had feedback, you know. And that's how I started doing essentially front of house mixing, but I was doing it from the stage at that stage by numbers.
Yeah.
And I had no formal training in that at all, other than the clubbing thing. And then that, the other DJ didn't return, and then they said to me, "Hey, do you want to join us full time and come with us to our next venue?" And I did, and I started touring and basically left town and quit school and everything, and went on, and I was 16 and just over 16 and a quarter which is amazing. Not for my parents, it wasn't amazing, yeah, but yeah. for me it was. And so I started, and then the next gig they had a mixing desk, and they said, well, you can sit it here, and so you can sit in the middle, so come down and mix us when you're not DJing, and when we're not playing, you go and DJ. Yeah. And that's how we did it, and that's how I learned the basics of you know, club mixing, you know, trial and error. And
yeah, signal flow
and everything, exactly. I did know the signal flow, though, because I was aware of, you know, inputs and stuff like that, but I didn't know, you know, I knew Mike Pre was high gain, Mike Pre, and it goes to the next stage, but I didn't really know what the sliders did or what the buttons did.
Yeah, yeah.
I, for the longest time, thought solo was when somebody was playing something, you wanted the solo, they were the solo. He was playing the guitar solo, yeah, press yeah. that button.
Well, I know it was the same thing for me, and when I first got on a big desk, it was, what are these things called, auxes? What are they? What, yeah. And, you know, scratching my head. Well, why would you need those things?
You know? It's so, I mean, those little things that we take for granted, yeah, now, yeah. I often try and bring myself, I remember, this is an inline console. Do you remember the concept of inline consoles?
Sure,
at first?
Yeah.
I mean, at first I was like, but hey, I don't understand.
Yeah.
And fast forwarding 4 years from then, I was working for free in a recording studio to get my chops up in studio life. And one of the engineers quit on the day. We had a big fight with one of the clients, and they said, okay, you coffee boy, come in here and finish a session. And it was on an MCI console, and I was tweaking around, and I had a decent chops because I'd already had live experience. Yeah. And I remember being on the inline console, not quite knowing what I was doing, except seeing the tape machines going, I'm getting a signal there at least. And I put the EQ into monitor path.
Yeah.
And EQ'd it, and they said, yeah, that's out. We like the piano sound, that's great. Okay, press go, bang. It was a jingle, so they didn't have time to think. And then they play back, and they're going, hang on a second.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm bouncing around, hang on a second, the piano sound changed. I'm going, not quite sure why. I'm going, oh, you know. So I just EQ it again, and then I realize, oh, monitor.
Yeah. Record.
Anyway, sweet. You know.
Which MCI was it?
It was a brown one.
Brown one. Okay.
I can't remember what it was.
A 428 or something.
Was that what I don't even remember the number. Yeah. It was I know they had a Harrison, they had a Neve 80, and they had a MCI. And the first one I did, it was on an MCI, and it was scary. It was just absolutely scary.
I started on a 416.
416, yeah.
Which was had 24 inputs. It was a big one.
Big one. Oh, it's a big one. Oh, absolutely. Really, really. And I used to think, well, you never need these channels. Why would you ever need those channels?
Yeah.
And then after time, you go, oh, they put this on here, and you realize putting reverb up on this channel, and don't put them through the reverb.
You'll enjoy this. I went to the MCI training school for maintenance.
Oh.
And
I had a JH20. I had a JH16, actually.
Well, there was one day with just tape machines, everything you want to know about tape machines. And it was the early days of SMPTE and locking machines together. And that concept, they had somebody who was explaining to us who wasn't very good, and he was going 1,000 miles an hour, and it was going right over my head.
Yeah.
I just don't get this whole thing, this whole offset thing.
You know, I know, yeah.
It was a very interesting experience to be down there. But one of the byproducts was they took us to Criteria, and that was right when it was exploding. And they still had Jeep's original desk there with the faders that went over the top, airplane throttles.
Yeah. And that, I think that was, this was louder, right? Or was it reversed?
Yeah, it was reversed. Yeah.
It was reversed, right, yeah. So you bring it to you.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah,
that's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, the synchronization, I mean, that's, thank God that's a dead,
yeah,
right. An unrequired thing, but I mean, we all were friends with the Adam Smiths and the Lynx.
Yeah.
LYNX, and offsets were just, I mean, I'm sure you did too. I got into being a fiend with the thing. I was like, I'd work out, it's 2 bars, so it's like 16 frames, work it out, okay, punch in, take like 2 bars of this drum part and pre-record it to 2 bars later, and just doing that sort of thing with 2 tape machines, yes.
Yeah.
Crazy. I mean, doing that now on any digital tape, digital audio workstations, it's a laugh.
You know, I'm not one that looks back at the old days with a nostalgic eye at all.
No.
Because I remember things like that. I
remember the hassle.
And the hassle of aligning tape machines. And
JH series, I mean, the MCIs, I mean, remember that little tray, and there's a slide out, and you'd sit there, and there were capacitors, variable capacitors, and the capacitance of a metal screwdriver would change.
Change everything, yeah.
So I've still got tweakers here. Where is one? Anyway, plastic tweaker.
Plastic.
So the inductance, I mean, it didn't change the capacitance.
Yeah.
The trouble is that you tweak the little things, and the edge connectors would all be a bit wonky, and you put it back in, and all the meters go, oh,
yeah.
You go, what's a dB between friends?
No, those days, I'm very happy.
Happy. I must say though, I do miss the cream that comes back from a tape machine recording. You know, like a well recorded, it compresses so nicely and just makes things so much more manageable and melt. They meld so much better.
It does. I don't long for those days.
No, you don't. No, yeah. I miss the thump that used to come back.
Okay, so you're in South Africa. Now you're in studio and you're getting your chops together. Then what happened?
So I was multitasking. Yeah. So I was a DJ, but in the back of my head and on the phone, my woman was like, "Yeah, this is very good. You're a DJ and you're a big star now. Let's get yourself a career. It's not going to last forever." You know, typical, you know, smart guy, I would guess. You know, but you know, you, at that stage I was 17. So I was thinking, yeah, I must do that. And after I think about 3.5 years of doing just DJing and just working in clubs, I decided to go and study at Technicon. I've still got my pass over there somewhere. Anyway, and it was basic computer science and audio electronics. It was a Siemens company.
So audio electronics?
Yeah, audio electronics.
No
as
kidding.
Well, yeah.
Wow.
So it was the basics. Then we had to do RF, and we had to do ham, you know, do all the basics. But you really skimmed across all of the aspects of it. Yeah. But so it was quite an intensive thing, and I was clubbing and DJing and going to bed at 4 o'clock and having to study. So I didn't have any sleep for years. And then the bands would start working, you know, and so it was a bit tough, but long story short, I did get got signed off and I learned a lot. I really did learn a lot. But then I really just decided to get into the studio side of things more. So I volunteered to work for free at a recording studio. And it was called RPM, recorded in Johannesburg. It was a big studio, pretty, pretty big studio. Bunch of rooms, all tied together, really professionally put together by an English company, can't remember now. Anyway, went there, and of course I'm the grunt, but I knew everybody because they'd see me do live mixing, and they knew I had skills, but I didn't know anything about a studio. So, other than sweeping the floors and making coffee, which I didn't really do, I just ended up helping the techs in the studio. And the one guy, John Lindemann, his name is, he used to say, "Hey, come in here. Pull that Eventide harmonizer apart. Pull out the boards. I'm going to change this, this, and this. I think is that." And in the end, I'd work out what it is and help him or fix it. You know, the one EMT 140 is buzzing down there. Go and see what's going on. And eventually, I became like not a proper tech, but I got a great grounding. And then go and set up this tape machine, learn this, learn that. Yeah. So by being yes, 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 I ended up learning a lot. And then I started at night for free, doing my own little records and stuff like that. So before all this, I was always into music as a kid. I loved listening to music. I loved R&B. I loved funk. I was just into that sort of stuff. I loved the Beatles, all that sort of stuff. And I also plonked around on the piano. Horrible, but I did. Took piano lessons at school. Wasn't dedicated, so it wasn't good, but, you know, anyway. So I really loved doing all the little, you know, tracks. So I ended up doing little tracks by myself, just buggering around. And then I started getting calls to do engineering for people because I did live sound. So I started doing engineering in studios. And at that time, there was a band in South Africa, which was controversial, Johnny Clegg and Sipho.
Oh, sure.
Kunu, and it was the beginnings of Jaluka, which was a multiracial band, very controversial, of course, under apartheid, not allowed to play together, not allowed to be together. The bass player in the band, Gary Van Sel, said to me, "Hey, do you want to come and be our engineer and do some live gigs with us?" And I said yes, and it was a complete change from what I was doing, completely bubblegum pop DJ and club and playing in clubs and engineering studio jingles and, you know, mass produced but live bands and everything. I said yeah, I did that, and I ended up doing live sound for them and doing multiple world tours, and they eventually started to go into the studio and do records, and they said, "Do you want to come and do a record?" And the record company that they were signed to said, "Do you want to come and work for me in my studio and build my studio and run it for me?" And that's what I did. And so that's sort of how I sort of had a little thin thread between it all.
And that led to Graceland?
Just before Graceland. And so, yes, that was just the beginnings. What happened for me as a DJ, I then got a job on television as a VJ. So I was a presenter on this pop shop kind of thing. Yeah. And I ended up getting a request to be a producer to produce, you know, young bands coming up. And, you know, I knew studio work at that stage. I was quite got quite sussed at it. I was into all the current pop music, so I had a decent ear. I was playing in clubs I knew what worked with.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's a great set of combinations. Yet I got this job with this ethnic African band. It was a bit like, it was a bit folky. It was a bit like Jethro Tull meets Peter Gabriel, is, you know, some of the ethnic sides of Peter Gabriel. So I ended up doing that. So it was a great combination. And so we did the first record in the first, the studio. I built the studio first for Hilton Rosenthal, who was the main guy. He owned the Mink Record Company. I built the recording studio, and the first projects in there was Johnny Clegg and Savuka, which is the new band. And you know, we spent 4 months doing it on modest equipment. I had a Soundcraft console. Mm-hmm. We had a, what did we have, an MCI? What did we do it on? Atari MTR-90.
Yeah.
MTR-90, real drums, everything was real. But there was a couple of little sequences and things of that such, and I started programming and getting to, that Oberheim was in the room. That was still in the room.
Wow.
It was all the originals.
Yeah.
And then we did this record, and why it did, but it got very popular, and it really did. It sold 2.5 million albums in France alone, and all of a sudden, somehow, Paul Simon heard it and thought, that's a kind of cool sound. What's going on there? And he contacted Hilton Rosenthal and said, you know, who are the guys on that band? How can I get involved? I'm coming down to South Africa. How can you help me put it together? And Hilton helped put the whole band together, because there was an all group of people that we knew very well, because we worked with them. I did the front house sound for, went on tour, multiple tours with Ladysmith, Black Mambazo before they, Paul Simon.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was all a little family, basically, an African hybrid family.
Yeah.
And Paul Simon came down, got the artist, great songwriter, did them all in Satbel Studios with his engineer, and it became a big hit. And then he said to Hilton, you should go to, because Hilton's thinking of migrating to live in Australia. He said, you should go to Los Angeles with your crew or your people or whatever, and start working. I'll set you up and get you going. And he did. He basically got Hilton his visa here, got me my H1 visa, or L1 visa. It was intercompany transfer. I got it. Paul Simon organized it for me. And it was, you know, when you have power like that, it's really quite quick.
Yeah.
Then I got sent over here. It was Hilton and I. With the two guys, and we came over here. He sold and closed his business there. And we came over here looking to build a studio, and it was quite hilarious. In hindsight, I'm thinking, going to Los Angeles, and I think I'm going to build a studio. It's pretty silly.
At that time, it was one in every corner, basically.
Every corner, really good ones.
Yeah.
And everybody knew their stuff, you know. Yeah. It was funny, but anyway, you know, ignorance of the youth is great.
When I first moved to Los Angeles, it was 1980 or maybe 81, and they had the studio menu. Remember the card?
Oh, yeah.
And I remember one
laminated.
Day counting up all of the 24-track studios, commercial studios, and there were 225 of them.
Yeah, Ellis Sorkin. You know Ellis Sorkin?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was an amazing time. Literally, there was one.
Beautiful time, man. It was just, I think music recording and, you know, dare I say music, but generally it peaked around about that era, like 82, 83, the recording got to its peak. You know, as good as it could get with that technology.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it sounded really good. And records, for the most part, were well played and well crafted. And most people that got into a studio, unless they just had dumb money, but generally they had chops at some stage. That,
you know what else got really good? The production techniques.
Oh.
And because up until then, if you listen to most records, there's a lot of slop.
Yeah,
people would go in and they'd play, but they weren't, the concept of how to play together.
Yeah.
It wasn't refined.
It was not refined, you're right.
And then it got to the point where everybody knew, okay, this is how we do it. Now we have to play. Okay, I got to be on the kick drum.
Yeah.
And all the things we take for granted, it was a process to get there, really.
Definitely. And the production techniques. I mean, the way they expanded because of, you know, people started wanting to make better and better and bigger sounding records.
Yeah.
The stereo images and the depth, digital reverb was a big one for that, definitely.
Yeah.
But the way they started smart recordings, I mean, way Bruce Swedeen, of course, you know, all those guys are brilliant. But the way they just knew how to mic things well and use the ambience in the room to their advantage and the console to their advantage, EQ, and it's just such a superior time, I think, for recording.
Yeah, I mean,
you had to have chops. You could do sloppy records, definitely, and have a hit. I wasn't saying that, but a lot of people, most of those people, were really sussed.
I mean, when you even listen to some of the records that were coming out of the smaller places, smaller towns, are even really good. Dave Pensado,
of course,
is a buddy, and he came out of the Atlanta scene, and some of the people, Brendan O'Brien came out of there as well, and Ed C, who big in Nashville now, but he was kind of their mentor. And the records that they were doing then were like just so great coming out of out of Atlanta. And you go, wow.
And they stand the test. I bet you stick them on now and they still smoke.
Yeah.
I mean, you just do a good record. It's that. That's it. You've done it.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, that's the whole secret, right?
It is.
Do something that is timeless.
It's timeless. And it certainly does. It obviously starts with a really good performance and an inspired performance, because there was some really, in those days, of course, sort of the 80s, corporations got very, very, very involved. So you had like a group of session players would go in and play on everybody's record, and they all played well, but they were a bit sterile at that stage, because everybody's just like dialing in their part and getting off, because they had three sessions that day.
Yeah,
so a little of it was a little, in that respect, it was polished and cold, a little bit of it.
Yeah.
But I mean, Earth, Wind & Fire springs to mind. I mean, it's a really great band.
Yeah, absolutely.
Obviously, Quincy's stuff, I mean, obviously.
How did you get into working in television?
Well, in that same studio that we got sent over here, Hilton Rosenthal, by the way, the studio is still standing and been owned by four people. And I just went up to see the current owner, who's Simon Phillips.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Where's that?
Just up at Van Nuys Boulevard, 5252 Van Nuys Boulevard.
Oh, I know the place. I've been in it.
Yep. I built that. I built that. It was a sewing room when I got there. It was just a brick shell with nothing in it.
It's next door to the guitar, California Vintage Guitars, right?
Absolutely. Exactly. And that used to be Zio's Italian Restaurant, which was really good food, but they moved. So TV music. So working in that studio, Hilton... So the U.S. stock market crashed in '87 for a change, but it crashed, and the venture capitalists pulled out of us, basically. So we had done a bunch of records with, you know, Paul Simon's connections, Harry Belafonte, Jennifer Warnes, all these people. So we had all these decent records, but they were ethnic orientated records, and Hilton wanted to do an ethnic record, and he had distribution through Priority Records at that stage.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so but either way, the funding got pulled out of it, out of his company, and he said to me, "Listen, I'm going to eventually have to go belly up here. I'm going to have to close down and cut our losses. I'm going to go and move to Australia." So I was a house producer, writer, engineer, I guess. So he said, you know, run the studio as you feel, but do whatever you want. So run the studio as you feel was the word. So. It was a creative studio for records of, you know, multiple, you know, kind of a cool place. But then I realized, oh, it's got to be a commercial studio now. So I got Ellis Sorkin involved to hire and get it out. And I think it was Ellis maybe, or somebody came through the door that was producing an artist, and they were not terribly experienced. I'll leave the name out right now. They weren't terribly experienced in getting the singer to sing, and it was just going pear-shaped. And I said to the guys, I said, look, if you want to take a dinner break, it was late at night, I said, I think I could get the vocal out of the singer. It was a lady singer, and she was nervous. You know, she was just nervous. I said, I think I can get the vocal out of the singer. Do you want to take a break, and I'll cut it for you? And they were sort of pleased. So we buggered off, and we changed the key, and I gave her a couple of glasses of wine. And lo and behold, an hour and a half later, after a bit of comping, she sounded half decent. And they did. They came back an hour and a half, you know, after dinner, and they said, I can't believe it's the same singer. And I said, yeah, you know, that's what I do. I'm really a producer. I'm just sitting there mixing for you guys because this is the studio, but, you know. Yeah. And the one guy said, I've got a project coming up that I need, ABC Television needs some music for. Maybe you could write some with me. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll do that. And that's how it started. Actually, it's the second thing, but either way. So he got a project, he said, to do some demos, and we did some demos for ABC. And they liked the demos, and they came back and they said, hey, Joe, do some more. And then eventually he and I separated because we weren't really getting on, to be honest, because their timing was just not off. I was like quite military and strict, and, you know, run a studio, like, here, 10 o'clock, we start at 10, not 14 past 2 day. Anyway, that's what happened. And then I started a really great relationship with the people over at ABC. And then I started writing for their library. They had a music library, and then they eventually got bought. The company got bought by Disney, and then the people at Disney said, "Hey, do you want to start writing for us?" And then I eventually started writing for them. And then there's, you know, many, many producers in that organization. And then I started getting word of mouth calls to write more and more for different aspects of their company. So that's how I started really getting into television music. And also, I did a couple of jingles by luck. There was a cattle call for these jingles, you know, and. I'm not the most musical person in the world, I mean, rock player in the world, but sometimes I get what people want more, at least let me say, I get what layman's words convey what they want.
Yeah.
And I think that really does come from DJing. I really do think, I know it sounds a bit naff, but I think being a DJ, more so than being a musician in a band, because it's harder to learn to play an instrument than it is to play records or, you know, being a DJ. So it actually is much faster to get into seeing what people react to, what music react to in clubs and or whatever venue you're playing in. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So if you play guitar, it's going to take you 5 years to get a decent guitar player so you can go out and then see what songs work, yeah, like the Beatles did. But when you're a DJ, it's like, yeah, buy a box of records or buy some MP3s, but off I go. Does this work? No, it doesn't. Does that? And you start to see what works. So I think that learning, that at a young age, learning that at a young age translates into understanding what clients want. Sometimes clients can be very vague. Sometimes they don't really know the terminology at all.
Yeah.
In a nice way, but
they don't even know themselves.
They don't know what they want. They're looking for something. They don't know what they want, and they may be saying one thing, but they don't mean something else. Yeah. But I think my dumbness actually helps. So, having said that, a couple of times I got called to do jingles, but at the back end of everything, when everybody's nobody's getting, all the big guys are not getting it. Let's try a couple of these small fries. All right, yeah, it's got to be something like this. And I got the clients, well, the account, basically, as they called it in those days. And so that helped me get into TV. You know, music or jingles at that stage, and that's really that was it. It was by necessity, just basically doing anything to survive. And I've always liked doing records and writing music. I've always loved doing that for my own stuff. But you know, just never sees a light of day, just for fun.
Well, it's definitely more lucrative than just being an engineer.
That's very true.
Or and, producer for that
or,
matter.
Or producer, and part of that when that happened really was, I was considering something else. Obviously, the studio was going to go belly up if I didn't get it really running well. And also, I did start, it was the middle of, it was like 89 or 90s. The music started petering off. The talent started rolling down terribly. I'll be honest. I mean, it was just horrible. So I used to get booked on some sessions where, honestly, they would sit there and plonk around. I'd say, maybe you want to play that note? And they go, oh, yeah, what chord's that? I go, oh, don't worry. And so, you know, so I just thought, oh, this is not good. I do definitely have to get off this. And so when something like this came along, I thought, let me go for this. This would definitely be more fun. So I ended up spending more and more time not engineering at all. I used to turn down gigs, but just doing television music. However, in that period of time, I did also, in that period of time of survival, just let's just say, I did also start doing tech work. And one of the jobs I got was I had a Soundcraft console, and I hot-rodded the thing to death. The guys from JBL or Soundcraft at that time still acknowledged, it's like, dude, this is a much better console than we designed, you know, but jokingly. But, you know, the head of the tech department had somebody, they needed some staff. They said, would you mind coming up to Northridge? It was 8500 Bilbo.
Yeah.
Would you mind coming up and just standing in doing some tech work for us for a couple of days? We'll pay you. I said, sure. So they actually started, doing more work. And one of the calls came in. They said, there's a big producer that's got a Soundcraft and it's not working. And we haven't got anybody to go out. Would you mind going out and being a tech support? Pretend you're with Soundcraft and go out there. So I did. And it was Oliver Lieber. Oliver Lieber was he's a great producer.
Yeah.
And he was working on Paul Abdul. He was middle of Paul Abdul record. And I said, da, 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 da. And I said, look, you know, he said, so where do you come from? You're a strange guy. I said, yeah, well, I'm a tech, and I'm fixing your console, but I'm not really a tech. I actually was a producer, engineer. But, you know, things have changed in my life, and now I'm actually a mixer, really, and engineer. So I said, you know, here's my card. If ever you need an engineer, let me know. And that same silly thing happened. Alan Myerson was the engineer on the project, who was a lovely mate of mine, but he had to go to New York for something, and he couldn't do a couple of sessions. And Oliver Lieber called me up and said, hey, do you want to just come and stand in for me? And I said, yeah, for Alan, I said, yeah, sure, no trouble. So I came down, we started cutting, then I just got on really well with Ollie. Ian, I got on very, very well. Not that Alan didn't get on with him, of course. They had a lovely relationship too. And then Paul, I got on really well with Paul Abdul. You know, she was the sweet girl. And we started cutting records. It felt like a little warm, friendly thing. And he said, look, you know, I'm going to ask Alan to carry on because he's got another project. He was doing Aretha Franklin at that stage. He said, would you mind just sitting in and finishing off this project? I said, yeah, no worries. It's short beats fixing Soundcraft consoles up in Balboa. Right. And that's it. And then I got, I started doing that. And then I did a bunch of other artists. I did like a lot of older artists at that stage, Foreigner and not older in that respect, but they were already had peaked, but they were just started doing records. And I started getting those sorts of records. Carole King was another one. And all these sort of records. And I really enjoyed doing it because there were artists I loved, the younger, and I was about 30.
And not only that, they're studio-wise.
Right.
So
it's just such a pleasure. I mean, Lou Gramm, for not this studio-wise, but just experience and just the beauty of this dude's voice. I was at the Record Plant mixing a single for them, and they were in, it was a very, very rock and roll moment, but they were in, I think they were on a cell phone in a cab in Hong Kong or something, said, "We can't quite hear the mix, but it sounds great. We'll be back tomorrow." But they did come back tomorrow. But he did say, sorry, Lou said, "But I think I haven't got any more ad-libs on the outro." And I said, "No, there's nothing else on tape." He said, "You looked at all the multiple reels." I said, "No, there's nothing. I went through them all." They said, "Okay, I'm going to come back tomorrow and stick one down." So he'd been on tour. He'd come back. He was jet-lagged. I had to get out of the studio because somebody else was coming in. It was my second day of a mix. Budget was going, I can't do that. So I said, "Listen, I've got to print this thing and get it. I've got to get it out of the door by 2 o'clock tomorrow. We've got to unload and get out of here." So he said, "Okay, I'll come in tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock, to do ad-libs on a rock song." He came in at 10 to 10, went straight in. He went, blah, 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 blah. Did a quick warm-up. I said, "You all right, Lou? You ready to go?" He said, "Oh, yeah, no worries." So I set him up. I think I just set him up, some like 87, I think it was. Stuck him in the corner, vocal booth. And he went, blah, blah, blah. "Okay, I'm a bit rusty, but here we go." He burned through about five of them. I was like, wow. Just that's why that dude is, his voice is just.
At 10 o'clock in the morning, no less.
That's what I'm saying, jet lag. I was like, okay, you won.
Yeah, right.
Amazing. So there was lots of lovely little things that happened. And it's such a nice, foot in each aspect of the industry. It's really, really nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's really fun. And it keeps it interesting. You know, I think if I'd have been a mixer engineer and things hadn't changed, I think I'd be a fat, well, not that I am not now, but either way, I'd be like a fat, boring old engineer sitting behind a mixer now doing the same thing all the time. Whereas each job I've done, like the TV thing, I was like, fish out of water, hadn't a clue, you know, how to deliver.
New muscles get exercised.
It's like, oh, okay, learn this. So it's fun.
It's funny you should mention, I had dinner with a friend who's famous engineer mixer the other night, who just seemed so bored by the whole thing and burnt out.
Yeah, you know, that's a worry. It's hard to unburn yourself out.
It is.
To get inspiration again. It's tough.
But if you have your fingers in different things, there's always something new happening, and again, new muscles are being exercised.
Very true.
And it just keeps you interested.
And I think we all a bit. Well, in this industry, I'm sure we're all a bit batty and scattered. And it's like, oh, I love doing this. I love mixer for 8 days. Then it's like, okay, digital. I'm going to repaint the studio. Oh, I'm going to fix this. That's what we're like, I think. I think it's nice. It's really nice. I have seen that as well with some really big mixers that do everything really, really well. But in the end, it's painting by numbers for them. And they do fantastic work. But, you know, it's just... It's a sausage factory, you know, and sometimes that's not inspiring anymore. Yeah. As is TV music can be for a lot of people doing jingles nonstop and stuff like that. It also gets a burnout, of course, like anything. So it is nice to do multiple things.
Tell me about your library.
The music library, right? Yeah. It's called Trailer Trash Music, and it's as it sounds. It's parts and cues and four pieces of music, primarily used for advertising trailers, mostly it started off as being a bombastic thing, but now it's changing as trailer requests are changing. But it's distributed by Five Alarm, mm-hmm. who are just got sold by Imagem. They're now owned by Olay from Canada, mm-hmm. and they're a big worldwide distribution company. And essentially it's a bunch of different styles of music for people to sync to trailers. The thing about it is, though, all the music is done in full stereo mixes and or stems, and also different aspects of the. So sometimes people just don't have the time to ask to do a custom score, of course, and they hear a bit of music like, "I love it, but I just wish the strings were there." And they were there, and so, you know, and that's not new. Most people are doing stems for movies, but for trailers, not so much. I supply them with stems, and then also the trash part of it. A bunch of the CDs are little elements. So sometimes people, these days more and more, people don't use one piece of music in a spot. They use 5 or 8 or 10 or 12 cuts, you know, mm-hmm. and sometimes they layer things on top of each other. So what I've done is done a key-centric sort of sonic, so it all works together. The keys are, the musical keys work well, so you can layer one song with another. You can crossfade it, and it will more than likely work. And then I have a couple of bunch of CDs that are just like big hits or big whooshes or those big those sorts of things, rises and drops and falls and that sort of things. And they're all in relative keys, so they all work. So somebody can pick up the package and just layer them with and make their own. It sounds very custom scored, really, and quite quickly.
How long did it take you to put that together?
2 years. Yeah, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. And I populate it all. I mean, I write it for it all the time. I've got other people, you know, sticking out cues and everything. I'm always looking for good other style writers as well to populate it, because it's nice to keep it fresh. And that's part of the key, you know. It's really part of it too. Just, you know, just trying to keep it. And that's the other thing, you know, as you know, the music industry is so scattered and the pie has got, the slices of the pie have got smaller and smaller. So for necessity, one has to be multitasking and multi-ability.
Absolutely.
You know, including making coffee and sweeping the floor.
Well,
and it's interesting. It's also interesting too. And it's a natural transition.
I'm like this, and I think other people are too in this business, where there's a, you know, attention deficit disorder. There's a big part of that where, you know, it's hard to stay on one thing for a long time without getting bored and wanting to move to something else. And it seems to be a trait of many people in this business.
Very much so.
So for a while, I felt pretty self-conscious about it. And then I realized, no, wait a second. We're all like that.
That's
to
fine.
Some degree. You know?
Mate, it's fine. Just do what feels good. I feel much more, if I just out bugger it, I'm going to do this for a couple, and unless I have a job, of course.
Yeah.
If I'm writing a job, I'll obviously do that. But if I don't, then I go, let me tweak around with this. Oh, I do want to fix that channel. I do want to modify that mic pre.
Yeah.
Oh, I do want to replay the, you know, fix the drum heads. Oh, I do want to, you know, do this. And it's related, but very, very loosely. I think it's really, really great, because then when you go back to doing the, you know, like writing the music or mixing thing, you're much more inspired. You're not that burnt out.
Yeah.
And it's all in the related field. You know, it's certainly better than mixing one day and then, you know, driving a cab the next day.
It's not.
At least it's related.
As long as you don't have to.
Well, exactly. Hey, listen, you know.
Yeah.
Ain't too proud to beg, I tell you. I'll get Uber out.
Where do you think the music industry is going? Can you see a pathway?
And you're talking the commerce part of it, basically the money side of it.
Yeah.
How people can make money doing music. That's a really hard question. Other than what's happening now with distribution through the Spotify's and the streamers of the world, and people basically making what I call musical business cards, which is their single or their song, to come to their show, I can't see it changing unless, of course, there's a big, stronger movement, which is quite a big movement already, to a more organic way of only printing on vinyl, and then people have to actually buy it because it's not available many places, you know. Other than that, and an underground movement, I don't really see it really, I hate to sound negative because I'm not negative, but I don't really see it getting better for money making. I think it's just, unfortunately, it's bottomed and it's going to stay there. I don't really see it changing much. I definitely do see, you know, unfortunately for artists now, they have to be business people more so than ever before, or at least their management does, where they have to consider, how am I gonna tie this in with my YouTube channel? How am I gonna tie this in with a Twitter feed? I should get an Instagram, so at least I get my followers to realize I'm doing a new record, so that when I post it on SoundCloud for free, they can download it and really love it and come to my concert. That's what I see going. I just don't see people stealing concerts. You know, you can't.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, I mean, and not that they're stealing music that much anymore, but it's free. People don't really consider buying music a thing. It's just really what it is. I mean, I think why would you buy it? I mean, really, people say, well, why would you buy music?
Yeah.
It's like, well, you really should be. Isn't it?
You have to buy something else from the artist.
That's right.
But I'll make you feel good, though, about all this. Two major banks gave their projections in the last month. Morgan Stanley was one of them, about the music industry, future of the music industry, and they see a tremendous growth by 2020.
I love them.
Tremendous. So going from $15 billion, which is what our global income
is
to 22 and a half.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
but obviously the breakdown is important in that.
Mostly coming from streaming.
From streaming, exactly. Mostly coming from streaming and concerts.
Yeah.
I mean, and merch. I mean, merchandise. And a big thing to touch on as a writer, you know, okay, some artists these days, a lot of artists these days write their own stuff, but lots of still producers produce artists' records and write records for them or whatever. And they're being left out really in the cold, because you get paid an X fee up front to do the production. And normally in the old days, you pay X fee up front to get 2 points on it or get a this and a that.
Yeah.
And you'll end up making a decent bit of bucks if the thing sells. It won't sell. However, that record may do very, very well on free downloads. The artist, I mean, sorry, the producer gets nothing from it.
Well, that's going to change too. There's actually a bill in Congress that will at least give a little bit
to everybody.
But, you know, the other thing is I find that most producers are asking for publishing.
Right.
A little piece of publishing. And they're getting it because the artists are understanding the situation.
Right, they are understanding. So. But again, that publishing is only going to be fruitful if they get a good sync, if they get a good cover. However, I think if you produce a song, you know, whatever it's called, and then somebody has that title of that song printed on their cap and they sell 2,000 or 10,000 of them at the concerts, then you should get a bit of that too.
You should.
And that's called the 360 deal. And that's what they're hoping for. And I really do think it's, I mean, not for greed. It's only
survival.
Survival. It's like, well, dude, if you want me to produce your record, you can't give me X amount of bucks and then say goodbye.
Yeah. Last question. What's the best piece of music or music business advice that you've either learned along the way or maybe somebody imparted to you?
I think maybe it's been quoted many times, and I'll explain it further, but the thing is, when people say the music business, they must remember it's 10% music and 90% business. And it's a sad truth. So many, many, many of my mates that are brilliant artists and talented people, I often have talked with them and collaborated with them on recordings for television or sync deals, and I explain, like, we're going to get a sync on this, and they're like, well, what's a sync and what's this? You really do have to know the terminology. It's not hard to learn. You really must understand where you earn money as a writer, producer, who's making money, who's on your side, who's against you. You really do have to understand that. And you also do have to understand that as a new artist, you're going to have to get reamed a little bit the first time round. Don't be greedy on your first deal, but you just give them enough. You know, whoever's giving you the chance, they're definitely going to get a bigger piece of the pie on the first time round. But just make sure that pie doesn't last for the rest of your life. You know,
be
smart. Get legal advice. Either from a well-informed multiple friends or from an attorney, but don't be silly. We're not all kumbaya. Actually, the artists and a lot of the, you know, all of us in this side of the fence are generally sweet, kind of fair people. But when it comes to royalties and money, people get quite nasty. Yeah. And the people that have smarts understand that. There's, you know, for example, sometimes we get together and write songs with friends. And, you know, if it's three of us, our deal is we get in, we're going to split this three ways, irrespective. If I got drunk and fell asleep on the couch and you two wrote it all, I still get a third because you're writing it in my house because I'm snoring, and that put you in a mood to write that thing.
Easiest way to stay out of trouble.
Stay out of trouble. Yeah. And we all know history for the most part, all the beautiful bands that we've loved and go, oh, they're lovely, and they're all coming up in the world. Next minute, 5 years later, they've had a big hit and they hate each other and live in different castles, and they like suing each other over I wrote the chorus and you wrote the verse. It's like, you have to, you know, that's one thing. Just get the business in control first.
Yeah.
Then learn your chops. If that's really, just understand it. And it's not hard to learn. Anybody can work for free, and everybody wants to be loved, but you can't live on love and freedom and freeness.
Well, amen to that.
Yep, big time.
Very cool. To find out more about Bobby, go to summerfieldmusic.com. That's SummerField, music, all one word, summerfieldmusic.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, or Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.